everybody, and welcome in to a special podcast here on Sports Talk Chicago, True Stories Part 2, A Conversation with Paul Babcock. My name's John Zaglul, and across this three-part series, with episode 2 being today, I take a look at the local Chicago sports scene and talk to people who are making a difference in their respective communities. My three guests throughout this series all have significant stories to be told, and my goal is to have this podcast series serve as their outlet. Before we get started today, make sure to follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports and hit me up personally on Instagram at JohnZax, Twitter at JohnZSports, and LinkedIn at JohnZaglul. Today's show is brought to you by Moochie World, where inspiration meets creation. Call 708-247-2100 to book parties, paint your own pottery, and have art projects for adults and children. Moochie World, creativity at its finest. And by the Windy City Thunderbolts. Celebrate the team's 20th anniversary season by purchasing tickets right now. Call 708-489-2255 for your chance to be a part of history this summer in Crestwood. Now, going back to the interview for a moment, today's guest has had quite a career in baseball. And his story, which defines grit, determination, and making something happen, is second to none. I mean, when I heard his story, and I heard about how so many people told him, no, you're not good enough, you can't do it, and he responded in the way that he did, it inspired me on an entirely new level. And I hope it does the same for you. So I hope you enjoyed today's episode, which is part 2 of this 3-part series, and I truly appreciate your continued support. So sit back and relax and enjoy our candid conversation. It's now time for our special guest. He played baseball collegiately at the College of St. Francis, winning the 1993 NAIA National Championship under legendary head coach Gordy Gillespie. After graduating from college, he became the head varsity baseball coach at Lincoln Way East, a position that he held for 15 years. Today, he's an assistant coach on the Andrew varsity baseball team, history teacher at Lincoln Way East, and now author of a new book entitled The Team, available wherever books are sold. Please welcome Coach Paul Babcock to the show. Coach, how are you doing today? Thank you for joining me inside Andrew High School for this podcast.
Doing great, John. I'm so happy to be here, especially with names like Roger Clemens, Warren Sapp, Michael Vick. I'm quite the athlete just like they are.
Well, Coach, it's only fitting to begin today's interview with your beginning, which, as you've told me in the past, has greatly shaped your athletic career and your life as a whole. What was life like for you as a child in Poplar Grove, and how did that experience influence your life today?
Absolutely. Growing up on a farm with 9 siblings, so I was the youngest of 10. My parents were just such a great influence, taught me, you know, lie, cheat, or steal. You give it your best all the time. And really working on a farm, baling hay, a lot of adventures I had in the open space. It was quite a childhood.
What were the challenges of being the youngest of 10 siblings? Was there anything specific that you came across that was very tough for you being the youngest of 10?
Actually, it was probably the easiest because my parents, by the time, they were older when I was growing up, so they were probably saying, all right, do whatever you want. My siblings always said that I was the most spoiled one. I said I was just the favorite because I figured out how to do things the right way.
Thinking about the farm environment now and your brothers and sisters, how did those two aspects specifically contribute to your interest in athletics? Because I know in the book you had talked about following in your brother's footsteps and playing a game on the farm called silo ball to improve your baseball skills. What role did growing up in that environment play in your athletic career?
Absolutely. I had a sister that was 3 years older than me, and she was quite athletic, and everybody would always say how great she was. So she inspired me, as well as my brothers who played all sports, and I just wanted to be outside and active. And I had a great imagination. Silo ball was something in the book. It's one of my favorite parts because it ties in with what happens near the end of the book. And the silo itself was like throwing the ball against a brick wall. But I could do it over and over and over again. There are some variations to it. And it made me grow to love baseball and was really the seed that grew into a wonderful experience that really helped me become the man I wanted to be.
You know, you mentioned that you played all sports as a kid, too, in the book, not just baseball. And even collegiately, you played football your freshman year over at St. Francis. And it seems like today, in baseball specifically, you've got kids who are deciding to specialize in the sport instead of becoming athletes and playing everything like you did. Do you see that a lot as a coach? And what are your thoughts on that philosophy specifically?
Well, I always tell kids, the more sports you can play, the better off you're going to be. I really believe that if you focus on one sport too early and you're working the same muscle groups, I think a lot of times kids will have knee injuries because you do the exact same cuts, you're performing the exact same, I don't know what you'd probably say with fundamentals for certain sports, and you don't develop other muscles, other tendons, things like that. I really think, and plus you compete differently. Each sport's a little more aggressive. You know, if you're in football and basketball, you go from football to basketball. You got to learn not to foul and to be too aggressive. So there's just different levels of competition. And I think the more that you can do that, the better off you're going to be. The reason I gave up football is getting beat up all the time. I was only 5'10", 170 pounds. As a running back, you're not going to last too long when the guys are a lot bigger than you are.
Coach Paul Babcock here on Sports Talk Chicago. And Coach, going back to your career, tell me about a former coach of yours named John Maitland and what he did to ensure that you'd be prepared to play baseball at St. Francis.
Well, I think number one is he made baseball fun. Everybody who played for him enjoyed the game because he was always coming up with trick plays. The fundamentals were paramount for him. But trick plays were always people's favorite. And we'd just laugh and joke around. We'd play tough competition. And he was always encouraging. The biggest influence he had, besides teaching me how to play the game, what I believe is the right way, the way you wear your uniform is important, he got a lot of those ideas from Gordy. He met Gordy at clinics, and always when he heard Gordy was speaking, he'd go see him. He actually introduced me to Gordy, and in sixth grade, I decided I wanted to go see and play for Gordy Gillespie. That shows you something special about that man, because if you're in sixth grade, who makes that kind of decision? I want to play college baseball for that guy? That's not a normal thought for a sixth grader.
And what's interesting, though, is that, you know, he had such this great influence on you, but you later found out when you talked to him about trying to call Gordy Gillespie and make a pitch for you to play on St. Francis, he ended up not doing that. So tell me about that experience, when you found out, and how did things end up working out in your favor?
That actually was not John Maitland. Oh. John Maitland was a Pony League coach, my high school coach, who, good guy, worked hard, but he just wasn't quite the same as John Maitland. And I didn't have the experience that I did in high school that I did. And that's partly athletes moving on and a lot of different reasons. But the coach that I had that made the call for me was a football coach by the name of Tom Shields. He also coached basketball, won a state championship at Providence St. Mel. He made the call to Gordy. And that really, he said to me after he made the call and I knew I was going to go there, he said to me, "Don't let me down. I stake my reputation on you." And that stuck with me. I knew that I had to work hard because I didn't want somebody to say, "Well, that guy, he doesn't know what he's talking about."
So do you feel that certain guys today, as in your case, maybe have better experiences with their travel or their summer league coach in comparison to their high school coach? How does that relate to what you went through? And then also, does that apply in today's scenario?
I don't really want to say anything negative about my high school coach, because it was really more that he wasn't prepared to be a high school baseball coach. He's gotten better since then, but he didn't go to a lot of clinics and was never a coach before. I think high school coaches today are really prepared. They go to a lot of clinics. They really care about the fundamentals and doing things the right way. I think the biggest difference from some travel teams and little leagues and stuff like that, it is a little bit more fun when you only have 12 players and everybody gets to play. Let's face it, when you get to high school and we keep more players, you're not going to satisfy everybody. People are used to playing because they pay to play. But when they get into high school, you can sit the bench more, and nobody's going to be your fan when you're sitting on the bench.
So fortunately now, going back to your story, due to the athletic director's help, you go to St. Francis. And in your freshman year, you play football, you find some success, but baseball was a different story. You ended up not playing your freshman year and then decided that you needed to quit football to focus on earning some playing time on the baseball diamond. That obviously was a leap of faith for you, to abandon one sport that you succeeded in for another that guaranteed no playing time whatsoever. Why did you take that leap of faith and make that transition to the diamond?
Well, if you saw me as an athlete, you'd probably say, That wasn't that big a leap of faith, that football was not necessarily in the cards. I wouldn't say I had a lot of success in football either. I was right along with everybody else. I saw that I could compete with them, but I wasn't going to compete immediately for a starting job as a freshman. Now, you use the word quit. That's something I can never use. Of course, I say I retired. I even said to Coach Gordy, had a discussion with him, I don't want you to think I'm a quitter. If you think that, I'll stick out the 4 years. I knew that I need to move on for health reasons more than anything else, because being safe at that level, that's a whole new level of collegiate football, bigger, stronger, faster. And in baseball, I just thought if I'd had a shot to play at all, I definitely had to give up the one sport.
So after you make that transition and work to earn some playing time, a coach by the name of Tony Delgado tells you, quote, from your book, Paul, the coaching staff has determined that you will never play at St. Francis. You are a tremendous young man who works really hard, but you will never see the field. You are more than welcome to be a part of the team as a courtesy runner, but that is the only time you will play, end quote. What kind of impact did Coach Delgado's statement have on you? And did you begin to wonder whether you made the right decision to leave football and focus on baseball?
No, I never doubted it. When he told me that, to me, the greatest success stories start that way. You can't. I think people that are successful in life take that. People that quit, that's why they aren't successful. People that listen to that and say, okay, I'll show you, and that's exactly what I did. I said, all right, you may think that, but I'm going to show you. Coach Delgado and I actually had a conversation that in the book originally I said, I kept repeating Coach Delgado's words. He said, wait a second, I was the messenger. It wasn't me, it was a coaching staff. But to me, he was the guy I wanted to show. And I don't work that hard if it wasn't for somebody telling me you're not going to play. Maybe College of St. Francis doesn't win the national championship if I don't work that hard. Maybe, just maybe, I inspired my teammates to work even harder because they said, if this kid's going to stay after it all the time, get it. I really think it's like a Rudy story, that people see somebody work harder and they go, well, I got to bust my tail too.
You know, and a lot of people today, going off of that point, when put into that situation, being told you're not going to play, would probably throw in the towel and quit. Just in today's world, a lot more people aren't necessarily willing to work as hard for something like that. What do you say to those people after what you went through and how you earned your way into starting and ended up winning the national title?
I don't necessarily think that every dream can come true if you just work really hard at it, but who you become as a person is more important than what you get out of it. I've seen so many people, maybe to a fault when I was a head coach, is that I tried to be completely honest with people. And because people were completely honest with me, when I was told that, that made me better. Other kids didn't necessarily react that way. Maybe that was a mistake by me. Maybe kids are a little different. I don't really think a kid who's a real true competitor, anybody who really is worth their salt, would back down from something like that. So part of me said, it was good that I did that, because if they do back down, that's not somebody I want in my program anyhow.
So you decide to let Coach Delgado's prophecy unfaze you, and you work towards a position in the starting lineup, not becoming a great courtesy runner. Meanwhile, as you're doing that, the coaching staff, they tend to take notice, and by your senior year, you're left with only three other teammates that are your age, because some players end up transferring. It seems as if things started to fall into place. What happened in those weeks leading up to the beginning of the season, and where did you find yourself in opening day?
You know, it's funny that I found myself in the starting lineup. I didn't think that I would. I knew I'd worked hard, and I had a meeting with Coach Delgado and just said, hey, don't forget about me. And I knew he was rooting for me because of what he said. He said, you're a good kid. We like you. You work really hard. So I knew I had that in my corner. But I also was the type of guy that wanted to make sure that I wasn't playing just because I was a good guy, that I was playing because I deserved to and that I could help the team. And that was really my biggest concern going into my senior year, is what can I do to help my team?
So talking about working hard, making it into the starting lineup, you know what I found interesting too, and I read this in your book, you talked about the players transferring, how you saw them being selfish and they weren't really team players. Can you speak a little more to that? Why they transferred and how that opened up the door for you?
You know, it's funny. Those are some of the things that I don't remember the most details about, but I remember little things in practice, things that people would do where I didn't see full effort. And I always thought to myself, you're going to have a regret because you didn't put everything into it that you could. Ted Williams, the greatest hitter there ever was asked, what would you do differently? And he said, I would have swung more. And he was the best hitter there was. He wanted to work more. So those kids that weren't putting in the full effort or that weren't high quality characters off the field, And maybe it was just the standard that my parents set for me. You know, a lot of these kids in college probably thought that was standard behavior. There's a lot of people that probably thought I was a prude or that I was a nerd for the way I went after things. But that's because I wanted to say I gave it everything I could. And if I failed, what can you do? You have no regrets then.
So ironically enough, you finally climbed that mountain and you worked your way into the starting lineup, but then you injured your hamstring while trying to beat out an inning-ending double play. Now, the interesting part about all of this is that you would initially grab your glove and you ran out of the field, but then felt selfish and told Coach Gillespie that you were injured. Why did you make that decision, and how does that apply to what you see today as a coach? Is there a stigma around players admitting that they're injured because they're worried about their starting spot?
You know, that's a really tough question. You know, I think sometimes kids worry too much about their health because they're worried too much about the future, you know, and they're worried about themselves. And I don't want to point the finger at little kids and say, no, they're not tough enough or anything like that. I'm not saying that. I think sometimes we do project and we say, what's going to happen? How will this affect my scholarship down the road? When maybe I won't get a scholarship if we don't focus on the here and now and do the best you can. In my case, I knew that somebody else would in the lineup besides me would have been better, because if I can't get to a ball because my hamstring prevents me from doing it, I cost the team. And to me, that was the most important thing. In my Pony League playing for John Maitland, there's a time I let the team down. That was the worst feeling I ever felt. I'd never wanted to let my team down. That's why it's called the team, is because team was always the focus for me.
What happened with Coach Maitland with your Pony League team, if you want to speak more on that?
Well, it says in the book I botched a suicide squeeze. We'd never lost to this team. And we had one out, runner on third, and I popped the ball up and ended up being a double play. And the game ended, and it was my fault. That's why I felt. Now, the game never comes down to one play. There's some things that could happen all the time. It is a team sport. But when the game ends and you're the last person to bat, of course you're going to feel responsible.
Now, you did make a different decision going back to your injury, because in your first game back, you took a swing and tore ligaments in your hand, but played through the rest of the game at the time. Why did you decide to stay in during that game? And take me through how mentally draining it was for you to return from an injury only to get injured again.
I actually think it was a couple games after I returned. I think there's at least one game between there, because I remember Coach Gillespie telling me, hey, don't worry, you know, a ball just foul here. You hit a ball hard at second baseman. If those fall, you'll be a lot more confident. So I must have played a couple more games before that game when I injured myself. But the reason I went out there is I knew I could do the things that would not hurt the team. You know, I could make the plays. But as soon as the game was over and I looked at my hand and Gordy looked at my hand, I knew I was done for quite a while.
And at the time of your injury, the team was 3-13-2, hitting .212 with a 5.23 ERA collectively. What was the team atmosphere like, and how did you guys rally together to go on the historic run that you did?
You know, it's funny, in Texas, well, let me back up a little bit. The coaching staff does such a good job of inspiring the players that the players know when we need to talk with each other. And I remember having a team meeting in just a hotel room and saying basically, don't worry, don't freak out. Yeah, our record's not very good, but if we stay after it, we're playing terrible. If we don't keep beating ourselves, we're going to be tough to beat. So as soon as we got out of Texas, and of course when you're in the South, they've played a lot longer than we have. They're not as rusty as we are. So when we came back up North, everybody else is on the same playing field, literally. So I looked at that as the winning streak was something that was very special, but we didn't even think about it. It was one of those things we went out and we said, we're not going to beat ourselves. We're going to pitch well. We're going to field well. We're going to put the ball in play and see what happens. And it was an amazing that we never said, how many wins in a row do we have? Never once knew. Near the end of it, I thought about doing the baseballs on the ground, spelling out the number. Just like I think it was Joe DiMaggio had that hit streak. I thought that would have been cool, but I'm like, I don't want to jinx this.
And I assume that made it last longer, because you guys weren't focused on the number, you weren't focused on the stat, you were focused on playing 100% day in and day out and doing well and getting results.
Absolutely. Brian Kane has this saying, it's hard to hit the ball when you got one eye on the scoreboard. And I really talk about that all the time since then, is if you got to focus in baseball, what's right in front of you? If you don't, Well, you're definitely out of luck because it's too hard a sport. Hitting a moving object that's round with a round bat, and we say square it up, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
So fortunately enough, during this amazing run, your hand continued to heal. You were even taking one-handed swings during practice to stay game ready. Then comes game one of the World Series. And as you prepared for the game and look at the lineup, your name is listed in the eight hole as the starting left fielder. How much did that mean to you, going from someone who was told he'd never see the field, would only be a courtesy runner for the catcher, to becoming a starter in game one of the NAIA National Championship?
Well, in retrospect, it's outstanding. But at the time, I had one thought. Don't screw this up for the team. Really and truly. And it wasn't that I didn't have confidence in myself. But I only wanted to be in the lineup because I was good enough, not because I'm a senior captain and a good guy. And Gordy must have seen something in a few of the other playoff games leading up to it. I had some success in those games. I think I had three straight doubles. Of course, I was really fast, and I was a good defensive player, so he felt confident there. He probably thought, you know what? Having one guy in the lineup that's not a great hitter, we're going to be just fine. But to me, yeah, I was super excited because I get a chance to help my team.
So you're doing well. You maintain your performance, maintain your starting role. And before game four of the World Series, your teammate John Mica said to you, quote, "You've really been the man in the World Series," end quote. What was your reaction to that? And how did that serve as a testament in your efforts to simply receive playing time, let alone serve as a key piece of this World Series bound team?
Well, it was rewarding that somebody would look at me that, hey, I was having a good series. Because the first game, I almost hit for the cycle. I didn't hit a home run, but in fact, the announcer said the mighty Casey has struck out when we come back from a rain delay. I was 3-for-3, and I think I struck out the first time back up. But to have somebody say that to you, I wanted to brush it off immediately because in baseball, we're a little bit too focused on hijinks and things like that, making sure we don't jinx ourselves. So I didn't want any part of that. I wanted to make sure, hey, I've got a job to do and I'm going to focus on that. Because if you focus on what you did yesterday, yesterday's home runs do not win today's ball games. It's about what we're doing right now.
Yeah, it's a what have you done for me lately sport. And I feel that that's something that is forgotten a bit. Some people think, oh, I did well a week ago, or I did well a couple of days ago. Why am I not in the starting lineup, for example? Or why am I not playing? But it's what have you done for me lately sport. What have you done yesterday? What are you going to do today?
Yeah, for sure. And fortunately, I had done enough good things in the games that Coach Gillespie said, all right, let's give him another game. And when I did something well in the next game, he said, all right, well, let's play him again. And to me, one of my favorite quotes in the book or paragraphs in the book is about my teammates, how great they were on the bench when that could have been me. You know, if anybody sulks or anybody complains, then maybe we don't win the World Series. The people who weren't playing were just as important as me being in there. And I think that's a testament, and again, why it's called the team is because we all know if somebody's sulking, how it can drain the energy. John does this podcast that I'm blanking on his name. I'll come up with it. But he always says we don't want energy vampires. And that is true in any sport. You know, if you got somebody who is not into the team, then the team's not going to do as well.
Moving now to the fifth and final game of the World Series. You started in left field, and you guys were out to an early 3-0 lead. But trouble brewed in the fifth inning. The Savages had scored a run on an RBI single, and runners stood at the corners with only one out. Tell me about what happens next.
What happens next is exactly what I practiced on the farm. Silo ball prepared me. I really believe that that moment in time was because of all that work I put in as a kid. Hours and hours and hours. Guy hits a ball to a gap. I take off running. I was really fast. That was one thing I can say. Most of my teammates would tell you he wasn't any good, but I worked on my arm, got better there. I was a good defensive player because of my speed. And I took off for the gap. I made the longest dive that I could possibly do, caught the baseball, had the wherewithal to get up, throw to my teammate who's the cutoff, because the guy at first base thought it was going to be an easy double. The score should have been tied. But instead, the guy from third tags up, he scores, we're out of the inning because we double the guy off first base.
Tell me about what happened as you ran into the dugout. What were your teammates and your coaches saying to you after you made that play?
You know, that's the funny part. I was so elated that I really don't recall any of that. I just remember feeling so happy that I was able to contribute and prevent something at that moment. Because we still had a long ball game to go. It was 3-2. I had to move on from that play. Literally, after the catch, I'm moving on to what are we going to do offensively to get those runs back. I talk in our dugout all the time. If the other team scores, we have to answer back.
And later on, Coach Gillespie would say to you, quote, "That was the greatest catch I have ever seen, and it is the reason why we won the national championship today." For someone who dreamed of winning, Coach Gillespie, a national championship, and for someone who was told he'd never see the field from the very beginning, how gratifying was it to earn that respect and that recognition from him?
Well, I'll tell you, I choked up right now. I tear up every time I read that, because to me, it was the confirmation that I was good enough. And that everything I did was worth it. And that if you put in the time, I don't care what it is, you and your what you're doing, you work harder than anybody I know since you were a little kid because you have a goal in mind. There's no doubt in my mind you're going to be successful because of that. And that is just what I did. I think this story is about all of us. It's about not giving up. It's perseverance. If you can stick to something, maybe you'll fall short. What if I don't make that catch? And we end up losing the College World Series. I'm not a national champion. Maybe I feel a little differently, but I still gave it everything I could. There's going to be times we fall short, but maybe who we become by going after what we want is the most important person. That's really part of the reason I wrote this book, is I do want to inspire people. I do think this is a book that can resonate with a lot of people because the human spirit is amazing. And I love following people who are positive because that's what the world needs more of. There's too many people out there that like to complain and bring people down. And I got to tell a story real quick. Coach DeHaan, the other night, we're playing Tinley Park, and we're up 4-0 in the seventh, and Coach DeHaan notices there's a Tinley Park fan, an elderly woman, who's walking slowly, and he goes, "Hey, Coach, can you get the cart and take her to her car? Because our field is probably like a block and a half of a walk."
Right.
What's that tell you about him? Coach Gillespie always taught us it's more about who you become as a member of society. If I'm not a national champion, oh well. So who? Nobody knows my name. Nobody knows that as a national champion in 1993. Who really cares? It's more about what kind of people we are and how we can help people. Coach Gillespie probably was a big influence on Dave as well, and that's part of the reason he did that. I told his mom, "You should be so proud of yourself. You raised that young man, and he is a great example for these kids at Andrew High School." And I think more people should know that.
And I think that's a great point that you bring up, because it seems like today, everyone, whether it be in baseball or even in this book, right, everyone's so focused on the sport. Nobody realizes that I think this book, in this case, and baseball and sports in general, they teach you life lessons that are applicable in many different situations besides playing 9 innings, playing on the field. And I think you could agree with that statement.
Absolutely. I mean, if we're being completely honest, maybe I shouldn't bring this up, but I coached for 15 years at Lincoln Way East, and I was let go after 3 mediocre seasons. And to me, it's not about that. It's about who you're making these young men into. And I know a lot of people say a lot of things about me, and I can't control that. And I don't, because how you live your life is proof of who you are, not what other people say about you. So I have no regrets in my life because I did everything. I tried to coach like Coach Gillespie. I'm not Coach Gillespie. But I try to pass on his lessons to our kids. And I would say 99% of the people who played for that man feel better as human beings because they played for him. And that's what it's about. It's about making a better society. And if I'm wrong, so be it, because I would not back down. I would not change a thing. What I did, maybe sometimes I could have been a little bit lighter with the guys because I take things seriously. I want to win, and I want kids to take it seriously. So in retrospect, there's some things I could have done better, but it was all because I thought that's what Coach Gordy would do.
Now, going back to the game for a moment, describe the scene after you guys had secured the national title. How'd you guys end up celebrating? What happened after the game that night with your teammates? Tell me about the whole scene.
Well, it was funny. We get in the hotel lobby. Coach Gillespie says, "Go get a shower, meet back down here in 45 minutes. And that's when he made that phone call to me and really made my head just explode, because, as you said, having a legendary coach who said that about me. And you know, I knew it wasn't a lie later, because in collegiate baseball, there was an article for his 50 years in baseball, and he was quoted in there saying that was the highlight. That catch was the highlight of his career. A guy who's been in the game for 50 years, boy, that's really saying something. And maybe it wasn't about the catch. Maybe it was about a little bit of me as a person. And he was rooting for the underdog. We all root for the underdog. But it was really a blur. You know, you're on the field and it's just like anything. Little kids watch the major leaguers. When they do a dog pile, that's what we're supposed to do. You know, get on the field and dog pile. So we do that. But we go back to the hotel, just change real quick, and then drive a little while till we go to a random restaurant. He bought for everybody there. Even some of my friends that went down to the game, and it was just kind of a special moment to see us just breaking bread together and enjoying ourselves for one last time together. Because really, I don't think there's ever been another time when we've all been together in one place.
Do you stay in touch with some of your teammates?
Oh, absolutely. Coach DeHaan is a pleasure. Coach Hurry is over at Mount Carmel. Todd Sipple, who was actually a coach during that year, he used to be at HF. There's a lot of kids that, I shouldn't say kids, we're in our 40s now, so we're not kids. But there's guys that I see that their kids go to Lincoln Way. There's other ones that we'll get together. Sometimes it's not for a few years, but we try to meet as often as possible. There's a guy that I am real close with who lives in Joliet, Paul Shavonik, who is the pitcher of the year. Dan Samulis, another captain. We'll get together quite often. One of the other captains lives in Wisconsin, and we all keep saying, oh, we got to go golf together, and it never seems to happen. But I would say all of my teammates would say this. If somebody needed something at 2:30 in the morning, we would be there for each other. It's like we became brothers. We bonded so much over that time frame that you can't help but want to drop everything and do something for them.
Do you see that today in the game, you know, being a high school coach? Because it seems like today teams or teammates aren't as close as they once were. Would you say that the teams you've coached in your past 20 plus years in coaching, have they exemplified that idea that you just told me about waking up at 2 in the morning, if someone needs something, going to help them?
You know, I would say yes, because like our kids here at Andrew, they do a great job of just teasing each other. You know, that's part of baseball, is right. When somebody screws up. We had a kid that made one error, struck out three times, and then ends up being the hero in a big game to win conference. And right as they were dogpiling, everybody goes, hey, you still struck out three times. To me, that's what the game's about, teasing each other and knowing that, hey, it's just because I love you, you know? So I think anytime you play a sport with people, you're going to develop that bond. Now, I think there's some things in our society that are a little broken. You know, it used to be your word was gold, but now if you go, I'm going to make a verbal commitment, and then kids back out on that. Now, why do they do that? Because coaches get fired, they move on. There's all sorts of situations, but I think that's terrible as a society. We're training kids to say, hey, my handshake, my looking you in the eye is not good enough. To me, that's 100% wrong. Is that if I tell you I'm going to do something, I'm going to give it everything I can and then honor my word.
You had declared in your senior year of high school that you wanted to win a national championship for Coach Gillespie, and it ended up happening. What would you say is the main takeaway or the main lesson from this story? I mean, from the dream's inception to the constant roadblocks and the eventual fulfillment, what's your message to those who hear and listen to this story?
You know, it's funny. I came to the realization that there were a bunch of other guys that had that same thought. That Gordy had some so close at St. Francis. He'd won three at Lewis University. He's a Hall of Fame coach. But we all felt the same way. We knew he'd come up short. And we're by far the worst team almost the worst team he ever had. You know, so all of us wanted to show that it's not necessarily about talent. It's about heart. And when you get enough guys who are selfless and care about one another, it's amazing what can be accomplished when nobody cares who gets the credit. And that's really what stands out to me. And again, why this book is called The Team is because of that. It's not just me. I'd like to say that I had a lot of input on that, that people looked to me, and why I was a captain is because I did things the right way. And hopefully other people said, I should do that. I don't know, nobody said to me, Paul, I worked harder because of you, but I sure hope that's the case. And I would never say you can accomplish everything you want. All you got to do is work hard. That's not always the case. But who you become is the most important. I know that's the third time I said it, but that's how important I think it is.
And just to build off of that, you also stated in the book that, quote, I finally accepted that I was not physically gifted athletically besides my speed. I decided to embrace that fact. I still believe that my heart and determination could help me accomplish anything in life, end quote. How does that tie into the book's prevailing lesson?
Well, that is what it's about. You know, I try to live that example for my kids. People think I'm a little crazy because it took me 13 years to complete one of my goals. I was always into fitness and doing things. I did 1 million push-ups on my 40th birthday. I completed my 1 millionth on my 40th birthday. And that's just one of those things I'm talking about. If you do something on a daily basis over and over, this book, for example, I worked at it really for 20 years. The last 2 years is when I really started putting pen to paper and getting after it and modeling it, molding it, changing it, doing all those things. So if you do a little bit, a lot, it's a lot better than a lot, a little. You know, so I kept after it day after day after day. And I think you'll see so much progress when you do that.
So tell me about the process of the book, because I know that you just mentioned you had to mold it, you had to redo it, it took you 2 years. Tell me about that whole process and how long it took you to get this into the stores and also the hard work and the effort that you put in to make sure that this happened.
Well, it was kind of I don't know the expression I'm trying to look for, but it was one of those things where it didn't feel like work because you're doing what you love. And every day that I would do something was another day that I got to remember things. Talking to a teammate, getting stories from them, you know, putting things down and laughing, making myself laugh at things that happened in the book. And my daughter saying, you can't put that in the book. That's gross. And I'm like, no, I think people will like this. But getting input from other people, that was talking to them about them. I really think the amazing thing about being a human being is learning. You know, every day pushing yourself. Coach Valvano said, if we laugh, if we think, if we cry every day, that's a pretty good day. And it sure is. You know, I found that is that everything's not going to be perfect. You know, you got to laugh because there's going to be plenty of times when you're crying. But if you're thinking every day, in our world, here's how I was able to do it. I got online, I looked on YouTube, other people, how do you do this? And there's everything out there. It's amazing how there's a whole university out there. I don't know why you need to go to college anymore, because you can learn any skill you need. You type it in, and up it comes, and somebody's willing to teach you it. So I'd be willing to tell you, all you got to do, I'd talk to anybody who wants to about the process of the book. But there are so many hurdles that you have to go through, but it's like anything else in life. You knock one hurdle down, you go to the next one. You know, you keep checking it off the list, and eventually you're going to be at the end. I got a little frustrated near the end because I'd read the book so many times. What it really says might be different than what you really want it to say. And I had to have a lot of other people look at it and say, oh, no, that's fine. Or somebody said, hey, you spelled this wrong, you knucklehead. So those were some of the hurdles that were probably hardest to get over, because I'm like, hey, I think this is pretty good. And then when I'd find out I spelled something wrong or something else was wrong, I'd be like, geez, I'm not very smart.
And finally, Coach Babcock, before we let you go today, there were also multiple stories throughout the book that detailed some of the not-so-serious moments with the team. I know the chewing tobacco and the chapstick stories come to mind immediately. What were some of the funniest moments that you had witnessed while being a part of this team?
Well, I got to tell, if it's funniest story, I got to tell the story about Tookie. He was a year older than I was, and I heard all these guys. It was my first trip to Texas. He was a junior at the time, and all these kids were in the hallway of the hotel room, and they're giggling and laughing. And then I was like, what is going on? And so I peeked my head into this bathroom, and this mountain of a man, this kid was, he's not real tall, but he was just muscle bound, you know, and he had poured water on the bathroom floor, and he was doing abdominal crunches. And every time that he would do a crunch, the water would squish between his lat muscles, and it would make a noise that sounded like flatulence. Now, we were in college, but we're still four-year-old boys when we hear that. And he was giggling so loud, and all of us, those are the things that make teams grow closer. Stupid tomfoolery that have no business anywhere, but everybody thinks, this is hilarious.
Well, Coach Babcock, I can't thank you enough for coming on. This was a great interview. And everyone, make sure to check out Coach Babcock's newest book, The Team, available everywhere. Coach, thank you so much for being here.
I can't thank you enough. It's been a blast. I love seeing you. And like I said, you work hard, and I know you'll be successful. And I hope people pay attention to all the things you do, because I've been so impressed by all the people that came before me. I was a little nervous to ask you, hey, would you mind having me on? Because when I see Roger Clemens, I'm like a little kid in a candy store going, I would love to talk to that guy. And hearing you interview him and not only ask him meatball questions, but ask him some tough questions, I've been so impressed. So keep it up, and very proud of you.
What an honor it was to welcome Paul Babcock on today's show as we talk with him about his amazing baseball career, his miraculous journey to a collegiate World Series, and his current coaching career. And his story, which is extremely inspiring, just goes to show you that anything is possible. I mean, he was told explicitly that he would never play in college. And guess what? At the end of the day, he helped St. Francis win a collegiate World Series. And to me, that's remarkable, that's inspiring, and that's something that merits attention. And remember, you can purchase his book, The Team, wherever books are sold. I highly recommend you buy it, as it's a great story that once again demonstrates that anything is possible with hard work and willpower. I'm so glad that you decided to join us along for the ride today. Before we finish up now, just a few quick announcements. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports and hit me up personally on Instagram at John Zags, Twitter at John Z Sports, and LinkedIn at John Zagluel. Also, if you'd like to become a subscriber to the website, simply type in your email on the subscription box of the site, click yes on the confirmation email, and from there, you'll be subscribed. You'll receive every new podcast and article directly to your email. And remember, Sports Talk Chicago is now on iTunes and Google Play. Simply search Sports Talk Chicago, and every podcast from the 2018-19 calendar year is now available. Feel free to leave us a 5-star rating and/or write a review. Your support is greatly appreciated. And finally, if you enjoyed today's podcast, make sure to check out my new radio show, every Tuesday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. on 88.5 WHBK-FM Chicago. You'll still hear my same hard-hitting Chicago sports opinions, plus we'll cover national sports news, have special segments, and of course, welcome very special guests to each and every show. Again, that's every Tuesday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. on 88.5 WHBK-FM Chicago. Thank you again for listening in to today's show, and have a great day.